Welcome back to the TV Talk Machine podcast. I'm Jason Snell, and across the internet from me, your host, chief TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter, Mr. Tim Goodman. Hey, Tim.
Jason, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. It's good to be back.
It is good to be back. You were gone. It's good to have you back.
Yes. Well, nobody. We did that trick where we recorded a fake episode, and well, it was a real episode, but it was fakely posted a week after we recorded it.
Yeah, we're pretty transparent about our fakery, though.
Yeah, sure. We opened up to the listeners about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we there's nothing to hide here.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. It's good to be back, though, after a couple of weeks away. Some nice feedback we got for that episode about the future of TV. In fact, there were a couple of people who said you guys should do those evergreen subjects more often, like not just when you have to record an extra episode, to which I thought, oh, that's so much work. It involves like planning and thinking.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Uh-huh. We try not to do that.
By the way, I explained to someone the other day who asked about original OG TVTM, and I got no more than maybe 3 minutes into trying to explain all the voices, and this person's eyes glazed over.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, it's pretty much, yeah, this is better. I said, if you actually want to know about television, just listen now. It's different, not better. It's different.
It's different. That was one of my favorite podcasts of all time. Yeah. You can find links to those old episodes on the About This Show page on the current TV Talk Machine. They're all there. Don't listen to them. You won't understand it. But episode one was titled Chronicle TV Critics New Podcast, and it went downhill from there.
And it was good because the Chronicle didn't know we were doing it then, so they actually have a little name on there. But they're like, who? They didn't discover us for like 2 years.
No, I like how they put little audio tags on the beginning to declare that they were Chronicle podcasts that were recorded by people who weren't aware of what podcasts were. So every episode of the OG TVDM would start off with sort of like, ding, ding, you're listening to a San Francisco Chronicle podcast? Ding, ding. And then it's like, what is, the classic though, but not information content very low.
Too funny.
That was my first favorite podcast. It was like the Ricky Gervais Show and then the TV Talk Machine.
Wow, that's very nice. That's very nice.
And here we are.
And Ricky Gervais did an interview with me because he was a podcast dude and he got it. He understood it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was huge at that time. He's still huge, but he was huge at that time.
That podcast was the first, I think that was the first huge hit podcast where people were listening in. I mean, I think he was like in the Guinness Book of World Records at one point because it was the most downloaded podcast ever. So yeah, this is, I'm sitting here trying to do the math. It's something like, this is something like the 250-something episode of TVTM if you stack them all together.
Wow.
Which we don't.
No, we don't.
We don't. Like comic books, you renumber every so often to make you feel young.
Yeah, that's what we're renumbering, yes. Mm-hmm.
So 76. 76. Good enough.
Wow. Spear of 76.
Yeah, Union 76. Little orange ball above a gas station.
Yeah.
Remember that?
I have an orange ball right now.
You should see somebody about that. It's not the old TVTM, Tim. I'm not going to take that bait.
I know. And that would have been 15 minutes of material on the other one. Yeah.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, with Joe.
Well, 15, with Joe. 15 minutes of talk, 2 minutes of material.
Right. That was our motto, I think.
Pretty much. Oh, good times. Hey, you wrote a lot of stuff. One of the little traditions that I have on a Friday is I look up the Bastard Machine page at THR.com to see what's going on. And it was full of stuff. There was like five things in the last week.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. It's kind of funny because I've always said that you can't really tell how busy I am by looking at that. Although this week there were, you kind of could. But sometimes we just do stuff in advance. And some weeks when there's nothing there or only one thing there, it could be a super swamped week for me of like, watching hours and hours of shows. And it's very funny that this happened this week in that we started a new thing at THR where someone in the upper management kind of like wants to like, hey, what's going on with each person this week? What do they have this week? And of course, you know, me, the first thing I thought was, well, if it's just to find out like what's going to get posted, sure. But if it's, I hope you're not tracking work because so much of the work is watching it at home. And so I joked, I'm like, oh, well, at least I've got two things this week. So if they really are keeping track, they're like, well, Goodman's got two things, the lazy ass. Go ahead and check the box. And then two people died, and yeah. Dan and I did a critics thing. So there's five things up.
Yeah, five things. So we should start with the deaths. Very sad stuff. And you wrote appreciations for both of them. Ken Howard, the White Shadow.
The White Shadow.
Isn't it amazing that this drama that didn't run very long from the was it late 70s? When did the White Shadow air?
I think it ran 78 to 81.
Yeah, I mean, it was 78 to 81. So never a huge hit.
Nope.
Ran for 3 years. And yet everybody remembers The White Shadow, mm-hmm. of a certain age, at least.
Yeah, I think it was. And I got feedback this week from people who caught it somewhere in the country in syndication, which is totally possible. And I came to it, I wrote about coming to it and reading about it in high school and thinking, wow, that's like my first show that I ever really liked. Or even I didn't watch much TV at all, and so I sort of paid attention to that one. And then, it's sad. I mean, Ken Howard, great actor. I went into it sort of wanting to note that he was in so many things as a character actor, and he was really good at everything he did. And he always stood out, and I had to put in there not because his height and his girth, he was a big dude. Mm-hmm. But for me, he's always going to be the White Shadow. I think that is true for so many people, and they did feel a sense of loss. And it was for a certain generation, there was a coming of age element to that series. It was also one of the, as I note in the review or the appreciation, kind of one of the early waves of quality television. Bruce Paltrow shot it almost like a film.
Yeah.
There were a number of excellent, excellent staff writers on there.
I was going to say, think about it as like the Friday Night Lights of its day.
Yes.
Right. He was the coach. He was the kind of a mentor and was grappling with like all the issues that the players were going through. And like for all the nerds who watched TV and weren't playing basketball, he mm-hmm. was their basketball coach, right? He was like, mm-hmm. he was the basketball coach inside the TV. And I mean, yeah. I certainly felt that connection to him as the White Shadow.
He explained plays, he explained defenses,
and he taught you about life.
He did. He was there for you. Mm-hmm. And Carver High in South Central, there was a lot of rough life going on.
Yeah, well, this was also part of that era where TV really tried to get some a deal with social issues. And this was one of those areas outside of, you know, a Norman Lear sitcom where they were trying to do a drama where his team, you know, is mostly black kids. But it's mm-hmm. a very, very diverse team. And there's white kids, too. And they mm-hmm. Who could forget Salami?
Salami, yeah.
Anyway, also 30 Rock, we should mention.
Yes, he was on 30 Rock, and he did, you know, he was also, yeah, he did a lot of stuff. And those writers went on to do other things. I was surprised he didn't go on to do some of the other things with those writers. But but 30 Rock, very famous for that.
Yeah, he did. I remember seeing him and just kind of really being happy that he was on. He was the head of Cabletown.
Cabletown.
On 30 mm-hmm. Rock, Hank, the head of Cabletown. Yeah. Oh,
also, he was good in everything, right? He could play comedy, he could play drama, he could be serious, and I love that guy. But yeah, he had meaning to us for the coming of age thing. And you know, it's funny that you mentioned it. I think if I had half the brain that you had, I probably would have figured that out and did a kind of like Friday Night Lights of its time, because I think that's really kind of perfect for what it was. And you know, if I had we had to crank those things out really fast. And if I had a little more time, I probably, you know, could have done some research. I bet you if you look back that you could find a trend in television right about that time where filmmakers of the 70s who could see, you know, there was still great stuff going on in filmmaking, but Norman Lear on television was doing really good stuff too. But we were just moving into that era, and Bruce Paltrow directed movies too. And so when he was one of the first wave of directors to come to television, And I think you could probably see that there was a change in the theaters, and that was starting to like people to say, not like they did, you know, 20, 30 years later, but probably directors looked at TV and thought, maybe I can tell a story on there, and hence a very white shadow. It feels like a film as far as it's taking its big themes. But, you know, again, you look at something like that now compared to here. It doesn't age super well, but, you know, it was of its time.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Right. So then the big shocker, I would say, Gary Shandling.
That was really tragic. I always hesitate to say like this one hurts, you know, because I think for some people they all hurt, you know, for somebody who liked Ken Howard more than just the White Shadow, maybe that hurt, you know. But recently the deaths that really got me were like Bowie for sure. Probably that was the biggest one.
Yeah.
But Gary Shandling, God, I love that guy. And, you know, it's for his legacy, and as like I wrote about, you've got two of the greatest series about the industry, and he was on both of them. Very, very qualified dude, and I took a long time to write this piece. I'm sure it would have been great to sort of stick it up as soon as I could, but when you write these appreciations, you kind of want to try to have a different tact or have an appreciation of some way. Maybe he's personal to you. Like when I did the one on Gandolfini, I had a kind of a personal connection to him. And that's why I wrote it that way. But in this one, I was like, okay, you have to talk about It's Gary Shandling Show and the Larry Sanders Show and why those were good. But I did kind of want to get to the fact that he was an odd dude who didn't really fit in. He didn't get the Tonight Show when he might have been a dark horse candidate to get it. And I think he was very aware that he was not super great looking, and he was not socially as sophisticated as some people, and he had these weird tics. And he maybe didn't get. I mean, he was a very blessed guy, but maybe he didn't get the things he needed. Somebody else would have gotten in his position. But as I pointed out in the review, when I finally kind of put those things together as a through line, is that by not getting a big show, you know, not becoming a Letterman or not becoming Leno and taking over for all that, he got to create a show about a show. And in that way, I think his genius stood out way more in those two shows, particularly the Larry Sanders Show, than it ever would have been had things worked out for him in a different world. And he ended up being a late night talk show host of a real talk show. His genius was allowed to come through on those two shows, but particularly Larry Sanders Show. And we're the better off for the fact that he didn't get any of those jobs.
I would argue, though, that Larry Sanders was as good as it was. It was like the show that could only be made by somebody who really understood what that business was. And mm-hmm. because he was not just a guest all the time on Letterman and on The Tonight Show, but that he was the guest host of Johnny Carson's show for years and years, mm-hmm. that he was perfectly positioned, right? He could have been a late night talk show host. And instead, he got to use that creativity to make this show about it. And you know, I was on another podcast talking about him a little bit, and I likened it a little bit to like Aaron Sorkin doing Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, where it's like kind of this fantasy world of right. what he imagined a show like that would really be. And I feel like this is an example, Larry Sanders, of somebody who knew exactly what it was like and then could, and all the dynamics, and then used that as the basis for it. So you had to be on the inside like enough to get it, to then step out and make this show about it.
Yeah. Cause he was such a natural in it when he was there, but he knew all the cracks. He knew all the weaknesses of the structure, and he knew like what you could spoof about between commercials and, you know, the no flipping and then talking right to the person, and having those people come right. off in ways like it was so great. Cause you could, everybody who's ever watched a talk show that has commercial breaks, when Letterman goes to a commercial break and he leans in and he's going to say something to whoever, you kind of want to know what they're talking about, right? Yeah. Like when Jon Stewart had Obama on and they go to commercial and he goes to talk to Obama, I would have loved to have heard what that conversation was like. And Larry Sanders, of course, that was such a great part of the show. Because it was never what you thought it was. It was usually always something mean and shallow and hilarious that happened between commercial breaks. I love that.
Yeah, it's just kind of brilliant stuff from a brilliant guy. I remember him very clearly from his stand-up on those late night shows too, and how great it was. And then It's Gary Shandling's show, which kind of gets lost in the shuffle because Larry Sanders was so great. That show broke my brain when I was a kid because it was like the Letterman show, so meta about knowing that it was a show that it was just kind of, as a teenager, I found it completely baffling because in a good way, like, what, you know, what am I seeing here? You break, because it was so, it was breaking the rules. It was breaking all the rules of what a sitcom was supposed to be.
Yeah. And it was just, and it was weird because of that. It was weird for a number of ways. And the fact that it was, did actually kind of track his real personal life at the same time. He was very keen on like, you know, writing about what he knows. Clearly that's how we came up with the Larry Sanders, but, and the business and sort of, no, yeah, the whole meta part about breaking the fourth wall and that everybody else kind of knew they were on a show, which is, it wasn't just him. It was kind of everybody. It was really goofy. I like the way you say it broke your brain because that's true.
Yeah. Well, it was nice to go back and watch that Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee episode with him and Jerry Seinfeld which I did watch after I heard the news. And, you know, those guys, those guys were pretty tight and like in the comedy era and also in their sitcom periods where they were right across the street from each other. And that was a nice, you know, not intended that way at the time, but, you know, he talked about death and made some funny jokes about it. And, and it was also a little bit serious about thinking about life and death stuff. And it was really bittersweet to watch that, but it was also kind of enjoyable to go and kind of, revisit somebody so funny and so talented.
Yes, and as I pointed out, it does have, I think he probably would approve of it in the afterlife, but it does have that unfortunate title called It's Great That Gary Shandling Is Still Alive. And but you know how true is that? I mean, because that's why they had it there, because that's what Jerry was thinking.
Yeah,
you know, that's what he was thinking. He's like, it's great that, isn't it great that Gary Shandling is still alive? So yeah, I think that Shandling, because he understood humor in every possible incarnation, would probably get a kick out of that.
Yeah, I agree. Well, sad stuff.
Yeah, it's a tough loss. That one's bad.
Hey, talking about you and Dan Feinberg doing one of these critics debate things. This week in critics debate land, we learned that Dan is a stick to it kind of TV viewer, but it is not a path to happiness. And you are a quitter.
I'm a quitter. Yeah, I'm a quitter. It's really funny because we when you know, this is, see, if you listen to the, this is what we should tell people. If you listen to the podcast, the truth can be told. When we were discussing it, we were like, well, how is this going to work? Because we had, it's a great idea of like, how, what do you do? When do you give up on a show? And we kind of got stuck. It was like, because Dan's like, well, I just never quit. Like, and he's famous for, you know, being a workaholic and doing all these things and doing extra stuff he doesn't have to do. And, you know, he jokes, you know, he jokes that, you know, it's his loneliness and needing more of a life. And I joke that, that my overwhelming responsibility with my family and not being a workaholic by nature and wanting to have breaks and be away from the industry and wanting to like not in this peak TV era, basically live either in front of my television or on in front of my screen, watching things about television, reading about them, that there's a break needed. And we were like, well, if we did that, that's a little too inside baseball. Cause it's like, it's more of our personalities and our life situations. But then we thought, you know, it's true though. I mean, Dan's always going to watch this, what he gets. That's his Howard and Fast rule. You know, and God love him. He watched what, seven episodes of, Flaked or the whole season, and you watch six episodes of just stuff that I would give up on, and I have no problem saying that, like, as I said in there, it's my, I don't have to touch the fire to know it will burn me. Like, if I'm watching an hour-long drama and it is one of the worst shows I've ever seen, I'm not gonna either finish it or I'm never gonna go to the second episode. So yeah, I don't feel, he feels obligated to watch everything that they send him,
right?
In advance of the review, not obligated to watch shows after that. And I feel like I'll write my review when I get it. And as far as the busy point, because we always talk about, you know, times of confusion, I note in there that like I sometimes get sent five of something or six of something, but if I get my review and I know what I want to write at four episodes, I usually start writing then instead of watching the next two, because I gotta crank this thing out,
right,
and then move on. So.
Right. So once you've got that review kind of crystallized, like, I see what this show is, I understand what it's trying to be. Whereas I get what he's saying, too, that, you know, well, if they send me eight, I guess I'll watch all eight, because what if episode seven is amazing?
Right.
And you would probably say, yes, but episode one and two were terrible. And it turns out that that's fairly representative of three, four, five, and six. So why am I, you know, what's all that extra work going to lead me to, especially if a viewer isn't going to get past the first couple episodes?
Right. And we did kind of, I think he and I have a little differences about whether viewers will get there. The viewers that I know, and I've talked to every feedback I've got, whether it's anecdotal or if it's actually my friends and I, they're like, yes, I am not going past the first one if it's bad. You know, he says people will stick in there. I don't know if they will, and I certainly won't. And the bigger issue, and I know I've talked about this before, I know Mo Ryan has talked about this before, and Seppenwall, and that is, can you really, and we talk about it in this review, what if it gets great at the seventh episode? And my feeling is, no one in their right mind will get to the seventh episode to build a big enough audience for this show. I mean, you might be lucky too, but why would anybody waste those previous 6 hours to get there? There's just too many other choices. I don't get it.
Yeah, I hear you. I see both sides of it, but I think I would, if I were in your shoes, I would probably, if I was on the fence, I would keep watching, right? But once you get that crystallized moment of, I know what this is, like, at that point, you should just write your review. Not to liken TV shows to computer things again, but that's what happens with me, is that I'm using a product for a while, and at some point, that moment happens where you're like, I'm ready. I got it. I know what this is now. And I could spend another, you know, week playing with the new iPhone or whatever, but once you got it, you might as well get it out. Might as well get the thoughts out and move on to the next thing.
Yeah, I like this little back and forth between us. Mm-hmm. It's wonky, and there's a lot of stuff in there. And you know, we didn't even get into all of it because, you know, I was watching a show at the time that we did this, and I've written my review since. It'll come up next week, and it's on Stars. It's Steven Soderbergh's The Girlfriend Experience. And, you know, that was one where I would have loved to talk about it more, because I struggled with that review, which it'll be up next, I think Monday, I guess it'll be up. But he did a 2009 movie called The Girlfriend Experience. Basically, it's about escort service, high, you know. But they tweaked it for the show. And again, Soderbergh's really not involved. There's two other directors who did it, and they wrote everything and they shot it themselves. And what was fascinating to me as a reviewer trying to write this was, visually, I kind of got some clues what they were trying to do, and I watched four episodes, and I kind of thought, I got an idea of this. And then I went back to their TCA, I went back to the transcripts, and I read the transcripts, and then I read, which I don't always do, because mostly it's just nonsense. When you look into the press notes, it's just whatever. It's useless. But this was very useful, because it reiterated some of the thoughts that I had about what they were trying to do. And, you know, bear with me here for a second. I tried to lay those out as saying, yes, I see what they're trying to do, but I want to make a statement that I think most people will not see it because it's too subtle. And what they'll come away with is, oh, this is a story on Stars that's about a high-priced escort, and oh my god, she's naked a lot, and there's lots of sex, so I like it for that. When, you know, and I think that's how it'll be either reviewed or it'll be watched by people. It's like, oh yeah, that's the thing. It's kind of entertaining. It's only a half hour, but boy, my god, there's tons of nudity and sex in it, and you know, it's mindless. But I think they were going for something deeper, but it was so subtle that I don't think the point is going to get across. So anyway, that would have been great to talk about something like, how many do you watch before you kind of get it, and then you have to kind of suss out whether it's going to be obvious or not to the audience of what you're doing. Because some of the things they're doing in The Girlfriend Experience are really really hard to figure out, and the main one that I'll reveal here, which is not a spoiler, is that they're using the camera in a passive way, so that the camera is not telling you how to think or feel. It's just sitting in the room while this stuff happens. And that's their big cutting edge idea, which is, okay, all this stuff happens. We pass no judgment. You, the viewer, will have to – do you have a moral problem with this? Is it – how do you feel about these relationships? Are they real? Do they have meaning? Can there be real intimacy between two people if there's an exchange of money? Big, big, big ideas, philosophical ideas based on the fact that for the first time, I think I can even think of, the camera and the point of the show is not to bring you to a conclusion. So I thought that was interesting. Then I looked back on the episodes I watched and I thought, huh, no, I was kind of watching that thinking like, wow, there's a lot of naked bodies here having sex. So that's I think the goal was admirable, but that's probably not how it's going to look when it comes out.
It's good for your visual studies class, though.
Right? Yes, right. I'll bring that. That'll keep them awake.
Mm-hmm. Sure. But the idea, again, that at some point it's, what's your job as a critic? I mean, we hear this a lot about, oh, well, it picks up half a season in, you know, or whatever. Well, that's nice. And sometimes you do revisit things, but, you know, it's unrealistic to expect that people put in 8 hours of work to get to the part where things start being good.
Yes, right.
So even if you were to watch all 12 hours of something on Netflix and then say, well, you know, if you can stick through the rough first 7 hours, then boy, it is okay. But why even, you know, what's the point of that?
Can you imagine, like, there's probably a good New Yorker cartoon spoof of that concept somewhere where they're at a cocktail party and somebody asks somebody what they've been up to. And he's like, well, I've been enduring the first unwatchable 6 hours of a show that gets better in the seventh.
You know, I was talking to somebody about Buffy the Vampire Slayer the other week, and they said the only episode they'd ever seen of it was the musical episode, and they thought it was okay. And what I said was basically, and it's one of my favorite shows, so right. If not my favorite, so I don't mean like you have to slog through the first 5 seasons, but that episode is not nearly as good unless you have seen every single thing that comes before it, because
exactly.
It's not a standalone episode. It is paying off plot stuff from the previous, you know, season's worth of episodes. But
yes.
You know, again, it got me that moment of saying, well, to really appreciate the Buffy musical, please watch 5.5 seasons of Buffy the Vampire Slayer first. It's true, but I refuse to make that a prerequisite because nobody's gonna do that.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
nobody's gonna watch 200 hours of TV just to get to 45 minutes. It's just not gonna happen.
Yeah, I agree.
Anyway, I really liked your piece. I like you guys going back and forth about it. It's really it is kind of insidery, but at the same time, I think Hollywood Reporter is a great place for it. I mean, to have the TV critics talking about how TV criticism works. It's a lot of fun. So I'm glad. Keep doing those. I was going to ask you, how do you do those? Do you just do emails back and forth, or do you have like a chat room, or how do you, or do you have a Google Doc? I'm curious about how you do those back and forths.
Yeah, we just do it on email.
Just email.
Email and then and one of us, who's usually the least busy person at that point, will stick it into Drupal, which
just
is the program we use. Yeah,
you just copy and paste it out of your emails. And
yeah, and you have to
document.
Yeah, copy it and
format
paste it out.
It.
Yeah, exactly, and format and get it up. So that's
cool.
Usually what we do.
All right, mm-hmm. See a little behind the scenes there.
Yeah.
Inside baseball about inside baseball. That's the best kind.
That's the best kind.
We got a couple TV reviews we should talk about.
Yes.
Happy Valley.
Oh my God, love it.
It's not so happy.
It's Depressing Valley.
It's a dark British police drama, so not so happy. Don't let the name fool you.
No, and don't let the visuals fool you. I mean, it is a beautiful, it's oh my God, it's not West Sussex. What am I thinking? It's
West Yorkshire.
And it is beautiful. I mean, you know, if you've seen, all you do see the opening title and they show all the surrounding. It's typical green English countryside. We don't think of like, we definitely think of like Oakland where I live. Well, some people who don't live in Oakland think of Oakland as a gigantic, violent city. If you actually live here, it's actually pretty green and there's lots of little communities and little neighborhoods. But in comparison to San Francisco, we're kind of out of the way. In England, when things are out of the way from London, they're just – they're like bucolic amazingness of beautiful rolling green hills, some of them. And that whole area that they – in West Yorkshire is amazingly beautiful. The show itself is incredibly bleak, but fun in the way that it's a great – well, maybe fun's the wrong word, but it's a great show. And it ties in – we talked a little bit about this in Dan and I did in this back and forth. The first season, I had to make it – I was the only critic, and I had to make a decision. Can I do this? And so I went and I looked at the things and I watched the first episode and maybe the first 15 minutes or 20 minutes of the second episode, I think. It's been so long. And I thought, eh, I'm not seeing anything here that's new or groundbreaking to me. Whatever. I don't really like it. I didn't really pass judgment on saying like I didn't like it, but I'm like, I can't review this. It's not original or fresh enough. Yeah, I put it aside, and then it became a big sensation among some TV critics. And so this year, I think I might have mentioned it here on this podcast. So I said, I'm going to take a look at Happy Valley Season 2 as it's coming up. I'm going to revisit it and see, did I miss something? And I looked at it, and I sure did. And I watched all of the first season, which is tough, by the way. It's very tough. And this goes back to your Buffy thing in a similar way. Not doesn't line up entirely accurately, but the second season of Happy Valley is better, I think. Mm. And it's also easier to get through. And to me, it's really more rewarding. But part of the rewards of the second season are earned by going through the first season. Because you know the characters, they're basically essentially the same characters, and you know them better, and you know their motivations, which is why television is so great. It's an ongoing story. But I definitely felt like season two, people could start there, but they wouldn't appreciate everybody and different nuances of it as much as I did having watched the first season.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. It is a valley.
Six episodes. You can get through it. It's pretty easy.
Right. It's a valley. It's not happy, but it's good.
Yeah. And make sure you have a like sunshine that you can walk out to afterwards.
Good idea.
Maybe like a loved one that you could hug.
Mm.
That might be good.
Watch it during the day.
Watch it during the day.
Safer that way.
Or go all in and watch it at midnight and have a bunch of wine and just
Six episodes. The sun will be coming up by the time you binge it.
Yes, exactly.
And then the sun will reassure you that life goes on and then you can pass out.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's how Netflix does it. How about The Catch? Shondaland.
Shambles Land.
Sounds like the implication reading in ABC's The Catch is that this is a Shonda Rhimes produced project that she didn't really have her hands on and that it suffers. Is that fair to say?
That's fair. I think she looked over that way and that was the nod that they said, okay, it's hers. And we'll talk, it's the Spielberg thing, executive produced by Steven Spielberg, who doesn't even touch it or whatever. So, but this was a troubled, The Catch was troubled from the get-go. They obviously want to expand her empire because she's got a whole night of her own on ABC and it does really well. But as I noted, I'm not fans of those shows, but I know from people who are that they're bitching a lot about two of her shows, definitely Scandal and Grays right now. And so then this comes along and it's, her hands are clean of it other than her name's on it. But when your name's on it and you're the executive producer, you've got to take some responsibility. And so, everybody is Shondaland this. And I was like, this is now, maybe we're coming to Shambles Land because this is, things are not so rosy in her world. I know that when she gets her hands on something and she actually writes it and is super involved in it, then it's her and it feels like her, whether you like her or not. And I'm not a big fan of that style. But this was somebody else's work who they got rid of. And interestingly enough, it's based on a book and it's been revamped so much that the people who follow the author are like, wait, how is it? She doesn't have a book about like a cat and mouse game between a thief and a private investigator. No, she doesn't, because they thought that whatever it was based on, they thought, oh, that's not sexy enough. Let's take Muriel Enos from The Killing and get her out of those sweaters and put some makeup on her and glam her all up and make her sexy and she can do with Peter Krause. It's a mess. So you have new casting. You have a whole new plot. You have big changes at the last second, and you have a new showrunner who comes in and has really no affiliation to the original material or the original pilot. But he's Shonda approved, and thus ABC approved. And then he comes in and says, "Yeah, I'll run it. I'll make it look like Shonda." But at the first, the pilot is so bad. It's an hour wasted.
I just looked at the history of this show, and it sounds like Kate Atkinson, the novelist, who is actually one of my wife's favorite novelists, wrote a treatment for a show that she was like, and so she's listed as a producer, and it was like with a British producer who was she was working with this British producer, and she wrote a treatment, and that is what has led to this show. So it's not even like based on one of her novels; it's just based on a TV show treatment script,
right? And I think that and then the woman who did it for the U.S. I think she took Kate Atkinson's premise, which I think she was a pathologist or something. It was definitely in the medical field, and it was definitely more of a darker profession. And now she runs a female private investigation firm,
sure,
in sunny Los Angeles.
Sure. Cop, not a cop, probably.
Not a cop, yes. This show, people can read the review. I don't watch the show, but hopefully they'll read my review, because I did have a lot of fun at it. I didn't, I definitely stomped on it quite a bit, but it's so crazy. Every twist is so predictable. You're like, oh, and they give you the biggest twist of the whole thing, right? In the first 20 minutes, they're like, oh, right, she's dating the guy. So, okay, well, now what? Now we know who he is, so 21 more episodes of her trying to catch him? Okay, no thanks.
It's good to know that the thumb drive from Agent X is still in action, though.
I thought you would have loved that. I thought, in fact, there's a lot of Jason Snell moments in shows,
right?
So where I just have to go, oh God, how do I get this pilot to Jason?
Oh no.
Just see this little part where he says, yes, it's going to be the biggest breakthrough in IPO in history. And I don't even know who I'm talking to. Who are you again? You're a friend of who? Right. Yeah, I've never seen you in a million years because you don't exist. Do you want to see the specs? That was the quote. Mm. And he's like, well, yes, of course I'd like to see the specs. They're on this thumb drive. Oh, my God.
Thumb drives all of everything.
Because okay. It's secure, right?
I mean, and portable, convenient. Mm-hmm. All right, well, the catch. Don't catch it.
Exactly. Miss it.
Miss. That's a miss. Mm. Want to do some listener letters?
Let's do it. Hopefully there's about a thumb drive.
Probably. Mm-hmm. Good tweet from Jason from the 864, who is so committed that his Twitter name is literally Jason from the 864. Who says, I can't quite explain it. I stopped watching 11/22/63 because of the weekly release schedule. Maybe I'll go back after all eight are done and binge it.
Oh.
I also have not watched past episode one, although I want to. I just haven't gotten back to it. And I do wonder if this is the flip side of not having that the pressure almost of like, oh, there's a whole season of Daredevil. I've got to watch it now with 11/22/63, where you forget about it because it's just on Hulu. And I just never remember to go back to Hulu and watch episode two.
Ah, yeah. I mean, that's maybe something that Dan and I can go wonk about at some point. Ooh. But yeah, the whole binging or weekly is definitely an issue. And since we talked about it here in this last podcast, it's still in place. One issue.
I'd love to see you guys go detail all the issues there about, like, is it good for viewership? Is it good for PR? Is it good for conversation? And is it good for narrative? Right. There was a nice piece this week on Vox about, again, banging the drum about like, hey, TV producers on Netflix, are you making a 13-hour-long movie or are you making a TV show with 13 episodes? Pick one, which I think it's an interesting – I think both are valid, but it's an interesting conversation to have about whether you're making one story or you're making individual discrete episodes that can be watched, one by one instead of having to watch five at a time.
Well, are you going to wait till 11/22/63 is over and then go back and do it?
I'm not intentionally waiting. Honestly.
But that's what I'm saying. But now that you're almost to the end and haven't started, are you going to just wait it out now?
Probably. Although I'm not a, binge five episodes in a day kind of person, just because with the kids and all that, we don't have that much time usually to watch TV, but we have been doing, we've actually been doing like Daredevil every night the last week. And that's been enjoyable. So that may end up happening with 11/22/63, where we get in a rhythm of doing, you know, an episode a night for a week or so, and then that season is done instead of the weekly pace. And that's kind of, I mean, that's not a bad alternate way of watching TV, rather than watching a new episode every week, to say, all right, we're gonna do this show right for the next week and a half, and then it'll be done.
Right.
It's a slow binge, but it's still kind of a binge.
Yeah.
The old slow binge.
The old slow binge.
Okay, Alice on Twitter, who did not give an area code and did not change her name to include
Alice.
An area code.
Yeah, I love that. Commit. She's like, Hobo Eric is now in his Twitter feed too.
Yeah, but this is Hobo. Interesting. Why do some shows get reviewed by everyone and some completely slip under the radar? The Night Manager is so good. Hashtag peak TV.
Yes, I can tell you, as far as The Hollywood Reporter is concerned, we definitely wanted to watch The Night Manager. I will actually be watching all of The Night Manager for my own pleasure, and probably doing like a critic's notebook where I check in on it. But it's The Hollywood Reporter's, we did do a review of it. It just wasn't Dan or I. It was a movie critic, because the policy at The Hollywood Reporter is we review it when it goes into a festival.
It was premiered at a film festival. So,
So it's in there somewhere. We did it. And usually when it's at a film festival, it is usually months before the release of the show.
Right. Cause the show doesn't actually begin in the US until, April.
Yeah.
So I think Alice is in the UK.
Yeah,
I suspect
probably
where they started broadcasting at end of February.
I'm so excited to see it, and you know, Dan and I were both kind of like, "Huh, we'd like to review this," and they're like, "No, don't worry, we did
it
already."
Berlin Film Festival or something, right. And yeah, forget it. So you might catch up on that. So that's the answer. Maybe also, Alice, is that since it's being held for an April premiere in the U.S., you're not going to see U.S. TV critics generally cover it. They either covered the premiere at the film festival, or they're waiting until mid-April before it lands in the U.S.
But I have and this is not a Columbo, by the way, but okay. I have a connection to Alice's actual question, because that does happen. I was going to review a new Netflix series where stand-up comics, or sketch players, I should say, comedians who are sketch performers, were going to do this new series where they got a half an hour to do, six of them got their own half hours to do all the characters that they had in their repertoire. And I was really swamped, and I looked, and only I was doing it day of the release, meaning somebody would have had to have already probably reviewed it, because when it's Netflix, everybody kind of does it in advance. So I was doing it day of the Netflix release, just about to start it, complained to my boss, I'm overwhelmed. And I looked and I said, oh, and by the way, only one outlet, some random stringer for the AV Club, has reviewed this show. And he's like, okay, forget it. And even more timely, DirecTV owns this thing called the Audience Network. As you probably know, it's, you know, they've got the MMA Fight Club thing on there. They had Rogue. I think Rogue was on there. And they have a new series coming out, or I should say came out. And so Alice, you'll be happy to know, or not happy to know, that literally no one reviewed that show. And today someone from DirecTV reached out to me and said, hey, if we got you more than two episodes, in fact, all the episodes, would you take a look at it? And I said to them, yes, because it sounds really interesting. And if you guys had not sent this out a mere week before it premiered, hello, maybe I would have done it then. So that's one of the reasons it probably got ignored. No one got it until like a week before it showed up. And frankly, you just can't do that these days.
All right, let's move on to this is a good one. This is a... OG, speaking of the OG podcast, this is from P. Page.
Oh yeah,
doesn't even need an area code because it's P. Page.
The mail
says, "Big thank you for giving The Path such a great review." Some nepotism is happening. My nephew is a featured extra starring in episode 5, or so we're told. We're hoping it will be renewed for another season. Also, is it true you've got some type of book in the works?
Yes, I actually do have some type of, that's a good way to put it, quotation marks, some type of book. Yeah, I'm writing a book of essays about music, and there's a lot of moving parts about that, and I don't want to bore anybody about it, but what will eventually come out first is, and that's part of the process. Either there'll be a Tumblr page. I already have a private Tumblr. But there might be a Tumblr page devoted specifically to these book essays, which you'll be able to click on the music and listen to what I'm talking about. Or there will be a sort of a Tim Goodman catch-all website, which is kind of more likely. That's being developed right now. And on that website, I will be writing about music, and eventually that will turn into a book, possibly a Billboard column, and all kinds of things. But it's starting, and one of the things that I'm going to do, if people are interested in music, one of the things, if you follow me on Twitter, pretty soon you'll be getting little tweets from me that say, hey, I did a Spotify playlist, here, listen. And yeah, and that's kind of like a little appetizer about what will happen when the book slash project gets more along the road. Nothing to read right now, but things to listen to, sort of like a little teaser.
All right, good to know. More to come.
Yeah, more to come.
Wonder how P. Page heard about that. Interesting. The grapevine, the rumblings,
grapevine.
Mm-hmm. Little secrets. Okay, Dean from the 707 on his travels.
Oh yeah, traveling Dean.
So much to report that he posted this one on the Facebook page.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, yeah. He posted a little note on Twitter and said, look at the Facebook page. So I went there and it was on there.
I like it. He was like telling us, come on, guys.
So Florida, best show to watch in the 850 would have been Jane the Virgin, since it sometimes has a church and a bar, or at least a nightclub, but it's one of the few shows we're keeping up with, and it had a rerun that week. So we watched Fresh Off the Boat and Archer Vice. The Miami season.
Nice. Really,
there were so many
smart options
to choose from. The obvious Miami Vice, Burn Notice, Dexter, the camp glory of CSI Miami. Heck, we could have used Flipper. But in Alabama, the only scripted show we could find was Heart of Dixie. I really hated Heart of Dixie. I would explain my feelings for the show with more depth, but I don't want to be responsible for your checking the box. And in the 404, it was season one of The Walking Dead. But we saw this billboard using The Walking Dead to advertise an Easter service in Birmingham, Alabama. And there is indeed a Walking Dead-themed poster or billboard for a church service, which is a bold move on the part of the
bold.
Birmingham,
Alabama. I'm going to go see that. Yeah, I'm going to go to the website and check that out.
Yeah, check out the Facebook page and awesome. You'll see it. But he really hated Heart of Dixie is what I'm getting here.
Yeah, I'm with you there, Dean. I'm all over that. Not a fan of it. But hate is a little strong. I can just tell Dean that I've seen worse shows, but yeah, it was not good.
Heart of Dixie.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, I think, I don't know, when he's been traveling a long time, I think he's a little cranky.
As well he should be. Yes.
Steve in the 808.
Yes, in Hawaii, the 808 state.
He says, okay, I wore my Mack Weldon boxer briefs while shaving with my Harry's orange razor. I'm ready for your next sponsor. I see a wine producer in the near future. Now on to some TV talk. We'll get back to Steve's letter in a minute, but first I want to tell you today's sponsor is Casper Mattresses, obsessively engineered American-made mattresses at a shockingly fair price. Now you can get $50 toward any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/TV Talk and using code TV Talk. We all spend about a third of our lives sleeping. You should do it on a good mattress. Casper brings together two comfy technologies for better nights and brighter days, latex foam and memory foam. So they've got just the right sink and just the right bounce no matter how you sleep. There's a risk-free trial and return policy. They'll deliver it straight to you. It comes in a box. It comes to your door. You open it up. You've got a mattress. You can try it for up to 100 days. And if you're not happy, they will pick it back up and take it away and you get your money back. So really, it is a risk-free experience. You don't just lay down on a mattress in a mattress superstore for 2 minutes and go, it didn't stab me in the back. It might be fine. You can try it for up to 100 days. And so you're literally, you can sleep on it. Sleep on your decision for 100 days and then make your decision. Prices are really reasonable compared to the industry averages. $500 for twin, up to $950 for a king. And you can get, of course, $50 toward any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/TV Talk and using code TV Talk. Terms and conditions apply. Steve in the 808. Do you need a new bed?
Love that. Love the synergy.
It's a little integration there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Look at us with supporters.
Yeah, we got sponsors. It's amazing.
We like sponsors who love us.
Anyway, back to Steve.
Yeah, back to Steve. Thank you, Steve.
Inter-letter advertising happened there.
When you saw that, you thought, oh, I got this. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought, I'll probably forget to read the ad earlier in the podcast, and I'll just drop it in the middle of Steve's letter, and that's exactly what happened. So Steve says, my wife and I started 11/22/63 last week, and we really liked the pilot, but then it happened. It is a virus that has affected a few promising shows recently. I'm talking about an interesting premise, only to have the show fall back into a network-like miniseries snoozedom. 11/22/63 has become such a drawn-out, repetitive mess that we've given up. The same happened with Wayward Pines, Man in the High Castle, and Under the Dome. It seems like these shows are trying to produce as many episodes as possible to tell the story, when less would be more. In these times of confusion, give us better shows. At least we have Better Call Saul, Togetherness, The Americans, Broad City, and Last Week Tonight with John Oliver to keep us happy. That's Steve in the 808. Interesting. About this is again about sort of pacing of series. And do you hit it hard with the pilot and then like back way off on the plot for a while because you're afraid you're going to blow it all too soon?
Well, first, before we get to finish that, breaking news. Breaking news, because Steve put it in there. Steve, sorry, you're not going to have Togetherness to fall back on anymore.
No, it got canceled.
Mm-hmm, by HBO today.
Today, as we record this.
Yes.
And release it simultaneously worldwide.
Worldwide simultaneous cancellation.
Ouch.
Sorry, Steve, that's not going to happen. I think what happens on those, and it's interesting, because if you have a mystery that has a payoff, it's going to pay off at the end, right? That doesn't mean the middle parts should sag, because I totally agree. If you sag in the middle, you're going to lose people. But there are some shows that spool out so much story at a crazy pace, you're thinking, how the hell are they going to get through? I mean, that's how Breaking Bad was at the beginning. I kept thinking, pump the brakes here, guys. This is a lot of story. You could have milked this forever. So it's a risk. I think you have to have intriguing stuff, maybe without twists in the middle, that will get to your twist and shock people at the end or make them cry or whatever your goal is. Because that's exactly what happened with Man in the High Castle. Had a big sag in the interesting beginning, big sag, and since I haven't finished it yet, gigantic payoff at the end. And then this is what I hear. Everybody says that. And that's on my list of to circle back on. And but even though I did like that show, and same thing happened. What was the other one he talked about?
He listed 11/22/63, Wayward Pines, Wayward Pines, Man in the High Castle, and Under the Dome.
Well, Under the Dome was they dragged it on because it became so popular. That's a different one. That's a network sensibility. Yeah. They said, "Oh, we're just going to do this summer thing. We're going to get in the summer game." And they came up with a great idea. They put it in there, and they're like, "Oh my God, look how many people are watching it! Let's make it
more
20
money.
Seasons." Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they ruined it that way. But Wayward Pines—that's the one I forgot. I'm sorry, but Wayward Pines does have twists, and it took a little bit to get to it. And then once it started getting twisty, it got really interesting, and it continued to have twists throughout. But it's funny because we talked about Dan earlier when Dan was at South by Southwest last year, and he was working for a different outlet, and I was there, and we're friends. So I was like, he had a hosting gig, and I was like, you know what, I'm going to stop by your thing on the way back from having brisket, and then I'm going to go to my thing at night, but I'm going to check you out talking to the guys from Wayward Pines. And one of Dan's questions was, this is kind of going to end, right? Just going to do one season and out? And they're like, oh yeah, I mean, we're dragged it out as much as we can. This is only so many books. And now we have season two. Somebody lied. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the person who said that is no longer running the second season.
Yeah, big shocker.
Pretty funny. So yeah, I think that there's got to be a combination. Maybe it's just storytelling. I mean, yeah, maybe the middle part for it's not working in Hawaii. Maybe he's got better to see sunsets than sit through the middle of that show.
The there's a sag sometimes in narratives, right? I mean, mm-hmm. We felt this. I saw this in Jessica Jones a little bit, where it felt like they, you start off, you want to burn bright, you want to set everything up and get everybody really excited, and then a lot of times they shift into that second gear. Sometimes it's the second episode, right? And they're like, all right, now we need to build. We need to do the slow build to the conclusion. But after that pilot, you're like, well, wait a second. You said you were going to give me this, and now I don't get that. Mm-hmm. I totally understand that that can be frustrating. I'm not sure it's about like the length of the series even. It's just, they're trying to grab you, and then they need to do some work, and that might be it's a tougher trick. Episode two, I've said this to you a million times. I feel like episode two is the clincher for any series, because pilots don't tell you anything, but episode two can tell you a lot, including this is a snooze. I don't want to watch this show.
Right. These guys don't know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's rare is the second episode that actually improves.
Yeah.
You know, and when you see that, then you're in good hands. It does happen, but yeah. And in fact, in my TV class, what I tell people, perfect example is Fargo, both seasons of Fargo. That is, to me, it's like textbook, almost immaculately paced. Some people have problems with it, but I'm a believer of if you have to exhale sometimes. And that means you've got to, like, all right, we blew all this stuff up. We had all this stuff blow up in your face, and there were fires, and there were all this stuff. Okay, let's exhale, and let's deal with the fallout, the emotional fallout. That's a good story. And while we're dealing with fallout, let me give you some other stuff that's going to build on to the coming six or seven episodes. Good stories do that. You can't just be crazy all the time, and you can't be lull all the time. You got to pace yourself.
Sounds good.
My theory.
Alan, in the 660, I had a back and forth with Alan a little bit. He sent in a comment that I went back on about when we were talking about the Louis C.K.'s
yes, I saw that.
Horace and Pete thing. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, why didn't you mention that this is disastrous? Because no people, if we're all paying episode by episode for a TV series, that's really expensive. And you know, my point was, we also talk about premium cable, which not everybody can afford. And there's broadcast versus actual regular cable, which is a difference there. But he was a good sport about it. I don't think we're going to come to any agreement on that. But I thought it was good. He was a good sport. And then he sent this in, which I think is really interesting. He said, I'm a cord cutter. One of the things I most about having cable or satellite is being able to participate in weekly water cooler talk about a show. With some network shows on Hulu or CBS's website, I can still do that, albeit a few hours late. You mentioned FX Now. Is that a planned thing, or were you just saying that would be a good idea? I would be into that as long as it wasn't too expensive. It's hard to wait for many of my favorite shows to come to Netflix or Amazon. Most of all, I'm dying to see what's happening on the most recent season of The Americans. So here's my question. A friend of mine is, like me, a cord cutter on a tight budget, and and he's trying to talk me into going in on the iTunes season pass for The Americans.
Ooh.
I'm considering it since, as I say, it is hard to imagine waiting almost a year for it to come to Amazon. Plus, then I'd be able to participate in weekly discussion about the show. But what could really tip the balance toward my going for it is if buying a season pass of a currently airing show helps the show get renewed for another season. It seems like, if anything, purchasing the season would be worth even more to them than just a regular cable viewer would be. So is there any inside baseball insight into whether things like season pass sales are factored into the decision about whether a show is doing well or not?
Definitely. That's the quick answer.
So buy it, Alan. Buy it.
Yeah, it definitely factors into it. And a show like The Americans, which they're sticking with, it didn't grow, unfortunately, but they're sticking with it. And but yes, so I think they're going to stick with it anyway. It's a prestige show. And as I wrote in my review of season four, normally you stick with something if it's a prestige show and you're going to get Emmys, because that can drive people to subscribe to you and do whatever. Well, the Emmys are ignoring the Americans stupidly, but you know, thank God there's a benefactor like FX who has decided, like, you know, John Landgraf is the guy who loves art and the art world and culture, and people should know that, because there's not a whole lot of those people. And I know that might be cynical for people to say, you just like Landgraf and FX and you're saying that he likes art. I'm telling you, he could have killed the Americans at any time. It's not getting any recognition. It's expensive. It doesn't pull in a very big audience. But you know, maybe there's something where they're going to sell it down the line, but normally probably would have pulled the plug on it, but he loves it as a story and he wants to see it finished. But take another series. Sure. Yeah. The over the top stuff, particularly paid stuff through iTunes, does help. As for his thing about FX Now, we talked about this a little bit last week. It is a thing. It does exist. it really is only not for cord cutters. Like HBO, it has one for cord cutters, but FX Now is not that one. It's
so
basically,
this is the cable login FX streaming.
Yeah, it's basically it's an app that makes like your life easier, and you can stream stuff on your TV when you want to. But for me, the problem is, you know, I feel like I'm already paying for cable. Why do I want to watch the ads? The FX response would be like, well, we're ad supported. And since you didn't watch it when it was on, and now you're watching it on your own through FX Now, you still have to see some ads because, right. Yeah.
But I get to skip them on my TiVo, you see. So
right. So that's – so exactly. So that I learned my lesson and like, oh, why don't I just not erase that from my TiVo?
Yeah. It's like – it's kind of like on demand.
Yeah.
It's you can get everything there, but you will also not be able to skip the ads.
Can't skip the ads.
Yeah. That was
not
good,
a true cord cutting experience, obviously. But if you did the HBO version of that, you would get it. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Here's a little more about the Americans. This is Joe from the 208, and he is writing about the Americans pilot, which we discussed last week. So this is the story in the episode last week. I talked about how people. There was a question about like how why aren't people watching the Americans, and I said that I 208 is Idaho, by the way.
Yes, Idaho.
How I watched the pilot and was turned off by it, and I couldn't even remember why, but I was turned off by it, and so I didn't watch the show. And had I known that it was going to be one of the most lauded shows of the last 5 years, I would have kept pushing through it, but I didn't, and I sort of missed the boat on it. So I've got a story about that, but first let's get to Joe. I watched the pilot more or less live, he says, and was so jacked by the end of it where Stan is searching through the Jennings garage with Philip hiding in the corner with a gun that I watched it again immediately. Then I pulled my wife in. She will now be known by the nom de plume of 208. Very nice.
Very nice.
To watch it again after excitingly telling her how awesome it was. So it made for a very uncomfortable hour where she sighed and rolled her eyes at all of the admittedly over-the-top scenes, such as when Philip donned the first in a line of cheesy mustaches and stabbed the guy in the hand with a barbecue fork who had ogled his daughter earlier. In the end, in order to not hurt my feelings anymore, the kindest thing she could think of to say was that it was silly and likened it to dumb guy Bond-style spy movies. My ego took a bit of a hit as I wondered briefly if I was being sucked in by flashy marketing without any real meat. I stayed strong and kept watching, and she has even come around to it and will sit and watch when it's on, but her reaction to the pilot was so visceral that she, like Jason, would be someone who would never have returned to it otherwise. I think that's about right, is that I think there was some combination when I was watching it of thinking that there was maybe too much in some parts, and also that it like didn't quite do as good a job of getting me on the side of the characters as I would have liked. It's funny. So last week when I was gone, I was up in the mountains, and Amazon has the Americans streaming. And the great thing about the Amazon video app is you can download episodes in advance. Netflix won't let you do that, but Amazon, you can download the episodes onto your device and then go off the internet to someplace like Yosemite and you've got them. You've got them to watch. So I watched the first 5 episodes of The Americans. And it's great. Okay. It's to the point where I wanted to watch more. I didn't have any more on my iPad. And then I decided this is so great that I really need to report back to my wife and say, we need to watch The Americans. It's very good. But here's the funny thing. Knowing what I know now after watching 5 episodes, I totally see why things happen in the first episode the way they do, that there are a lot of these questions about the relationship between the two main characters, their husband and wife, but they're Russian spies. Do they really have a relationship? No, but they're kind of building a real relationship, maybe. And that's the whole question in those first few episodes, is really like, even though they've been together in this house with kids for 20 years, this may be the start of a more real kind of relationship between them. And so knowing that after 5 episodes, I look back at some of the stuff that happens in the first episode and I think, oh, I get why, if this is a central theme of this show, why some of the stuff happens in that first episode that it does. But at the same time, part of me thinks that opening scene where Carrie Russell gives the blowjob to the guy who's blabbing about the secrets about the U.S. government, part of me thinks, that wasn't really necessary, and they just wanted to start it with a shocker to set the stage. And it kind of turned me off, because I'm like, what the hell am I watching? You know, So, but after five episodes, I think, oh, actually, I totally get why that is a good bit of character to understand about her, and her job and her history. But as a new viewer, it kind of turned me off. So I guess what I'm saying is I've reformed, Tim. you were right. Even after five episodes, I can tell that The Americans is very good.
Yes. Well, that's a great story about coming around. And we could go circle back to Dan and I. I mean, you proved that you could do it, right? I mean, that you would reinvest in something, even though, but you only reinvested because partly me and everybody else has said The Americans is good. But
I must have missed it the first time, right? I was maybe in a bad mood or something hit me wrong. But knowing that you and a lot of other critics are saying this is one of the best shows that's been out in the last 5 years. Let's go past episode one. Let's revisit it. Let's commit to going a little further down the road. And it didn't take me to very far down the road. Like episode two, I was like, maybe we should watch episode three now, right? I mean, it was it did not take me very long to really get into the rhythm of the show and understand what they were doing.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, there's some ridiculous things in it even early on about like coincidences of who moves next door, but still, very good show. Very good show.
Yeah.
And now I got lots of seasons to watch of that.
You
so
do.
That's great.
You do.
Too much TV. okay, this is a good one, and this might even be how we end this one. But I think it's worth even though we've got so many letters, we can't read them all. But really quickly, this is from Sam in the 646. Hey, Jason and Tim. Not sure if you're aware of the response of the internet to the death of a major character on The 100. Long and short of it is two characters consummate their relationship, two women, and then one of them dies. This is heartbreaking and soul-wrenching. Unfortunately, this is something many in the gay community have come to expect from lesbian characters on TV. The response from the community has been intense, as you can imagine. This was a loved character by many. She was superbly acted. Great writing put into building the relationship. And unfortunately, even though it's given us so many great female characters, the opportunity to grow and develop, this falls into the bury your gays trope. Mm-hmm. I understand the actress was cast in Fear the Walking Dead, but the way that the death was executed was poor. So the question for Tim, why does this continue to happen? It feels like the easy way out that so many writers take. I understand the emotional punch, but why can't gay characters be happy on TV?
Yeah, this is interesting. I know that this is a big thing right now. I couldn't comment on that when I saw it directly because I haven't got to that episode yet. I'm behind on that. As I said in the thing with Dan, I'm a fan of The 100, but it's and I think it's probably its best season right now of the three. This is the strongest, but I'm not caught up, so I couldn't comment on that. It's interesting. Because I haven't seen it, I know that there's people really involved in this on Twitter who I follow or related in some way are television critics. So they're deep diving on it. Mm-hmm. But I would say just on a very not knowing as much about this particular character, I think that whole barrier gaze thing, there's a history to that. That is proven. That's a real thing. I don't know if in this case, because I understand that they were surprised by the reaction. So, but this is a show that's been so progressive in many other ways. And I fall back on a couple of things in that if you talk to people who are writers and like there's a lot of shows where you could have a writer who is really progressive in their beliefs and has spent five seasons doing all this great stuff. And they do one thing and they get kind of hung up about it. They get strung out, especially in the age of Twitter. You know, that happened a little bit on The Wire. Some of these things happen. Invariably, the response that I get to when I talk to them sort of off the record on the side is they're like, hey, look, and I'm not saying this applies to this issue, but I think it could apply in some way. And that is dramatists want to have the ability to kill whoever they want to. Sometimes it's the contract's up and they kill them off. And usually on broadcast television, that's done very poorly. It was even done terribly in Downton Abbey. It was like, oh my God, of course they did that. That's just bad. That's a bad way to do it. Sometimes it seems vindictive too. It's like, okay, well, then we're gonna write you out in a way you can never come back, or we're gonna make you look silly because you're leaving us. I don't like the vindictive ones. But the core point of the storytelling, Jason, is that they'll say, look, hey, I've done a lot of great stuff. I'm not a bad person, but it was time for this person to go, and I felt like the impact as a storyteller would be great. And what I'm fascinated with is, because sometimes you can get into a position where you're going to be the bad guy in a basically a progressive argument about whether it's race or sexual identity or whatever. I think the author of a material has the ability to kill off and change whoever they want to, because it's like, you don't want to create somebody, a character, and then it's just like, oh, well, I'm not going to change them because everybody loves them, or I can't do anything to them because of this. You don't want the audience to control the destiny of your characters, is what I'm saying. Certainly not a good writer wants that to happen.
That's all the people who are mad. I'm reminded of all the people who are mad at Joss Whedon because he kept killing characters. And the idea was, well, that's part of the drama of it, is that, yeah, he kills characters and he makes you mad. His job was not to not challenge you and make you happy. His job was to tell a story that would maybe even wrench you. I guess the criticism about the death on the 100 is more that it seems like the creators didn't realize that they were playing into a cliche that they weren't aware of, which is that gay characters don't get to have happy endings, and that this happens a lot where, even on my beloved Buffy, right, Tara is actually killed by a wayward bullet, I believe, very similar to the death on the 100. Mm-hmm. And it's this feeling like it's a cliche that a lot of gay characters get punished on television for drama.
Right. And my response to that in context of what I just said would be to tell people, do you really think that Joss Whedon would kill a character off because they're gay?
I don't think the 100 killed this character off because they're gay either. I think it's more that maybe, and there was a piece by the showrunner on, who posted it on Medium, the place where all apologies go on the internet, saying I think that he didn't realize that they were playing into this this stereotype, this cliche, that they thought they were doing a clever thing that actually would have a huge impact on the other character on the 100 that would be lasting while they were writing off this actress who's going to be on this other show, not realizing what they were really doing was playing into the same old story that a lot of gay and lesbian fans of TV have seen time and again, because they just sort of they misread it. And it was like that was the big problem, is not that it was not dramatic. Because I had the same reaction you did, which is, you know, fans, on one level, it's fans are mad because you killed a beloved character. And I get it, but that's how stories get told. They're not there to make you happy.
Right.
Stories often will frustrate you, and that's just part of storytelling. But I totally see their other point, which is, yeah, but it happens all the time. This isn't an original way to go. Instead, it's starting to feel like, and it has felt for some time, like these characters always end up meeting these horrible fates. And I honestly think the creators of the 100 didn't get it, like didn't realize what they were doing when they did it.
Well, I guess if anything, that it brings that up to a, that makes this issue a bigger issue to look into. And I think that what would be interesting is if somebody like dissected it, and then maybe they have, because I haven't read that article, but maybe if you, let's say you have 100 of these deaths, you know, how many of them were, it was just poorly done, and it's just like, we're going to kill the gay character or whatever. And I know that minorities say, why is the minority always the first guy to get killed, right? I mean, that happens
3 days before retirement.
Yeah, all of that always happens. But I wonder if you pulled the other ones out who said, yeah, we were aware of the trope, but we feel like we weren't playing into it. We just felt it was right, and this was going. It was regardless of whether this person was gay or not. I would be really interested to see how that broke down. Like people unaware or aware that they're doing it because maybe the network said kill them off. This could be 10 years ago. And now it's somebody who's very progressive and a storyteller, and then it's like getting dinged for something that they didn't even know was going to happen. That to me is kind of fascinating. But I do think with you, you know more about this one, but I think we're in agreement that and I see far too much of this is separate. I see far too much of this on for fans, and that they're like, don't mess with my characters, make them happy. That's not good storytelling. Making your character happy and you in the process is not what you do. And, you know, very famously, you know, you start going to like David Chase on The Sopranos saying, as season three started, like, too many people like Tony. You're not supposed to like Tony. I'm going to make you not like him this year because I'm mad that you like him. You know, I'm mad that I didn't project in a way. You're not responding to the character like I wanted you to respond to them. Now you're embracing him. He's not a big teddy bear. So season three, ultra violence. And now let's see if you like him. So it's about being more challenging sometimes. So a really good storyteller is not going to worry about making the fans happy. But, you know, this particular is clearly more multidimensional than that.
Yeah. So I will put a link in the show notes to a piece that was your colleague at Variety, Maureen Ryan, posted about. Somebody did actually a little research, and it shows that of the lesbian and bisexual characters on TV in the last 40 years, 31% of them end up dead. So, you know, it's definitely a thing.
It's a thing, definitely. Mm-hmm. That counts as a thing.
And I think that's the bottom line is that maybe more showrunners are and TV writers are aware of this being a cliche now after this blow up around the 100. But I see both sides of this in the sense there aren't really two sides there. It's more complex than that. But I see as a storyteller wanting to tell a story, you've got an actress that's leaving. And from their perspective, they may be feeling like by killing this character, they're actually investing in the other character. Because now she is going to be affected by this death, and it gives Clark more to do and more depth to plumb of her character, while sending off this other actress who has to go because she has to be in another show. All good, but also having the writers realize, as I think the showrunner of The 100 realizes now, that a lot of fans are investing. More than just your average show in a gay character, because there aren't as many of them on TV and there aren't as many gay relationships on TV. And that when you do that, you got to be careful and know what the tropes are. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean you can't frustrate those characters. I think that the Willow storyline in Buffy after Tara died was interesting, and she ended up with a new girlfriend. And, you know, it's not that Willow didn't end up happy at the end, but you got to be aware that you're playing with fire and that there's a track record, and you might your fans you need to know where their mindset is. But that doesn't necessarily mean you never do anything to your characters either to make them miserable, because that is part of storytelling.
Yeah, I mean, this to me it's fascinating in a lot of ways, you know, because it's from a storytelling perspective, look, there's a lot to dissect on that, but it's fascinating from a storytelling perspective, because you can say, yes, I totally the gay creator of the show and say, wait, I'm you know what I mean? I would be interested to see if that happened too. But I think it's fascinating in that, like, you have to be careful, because there is this trend and this trope that's happened. And if you didn't contribute to it at all, and you were being more progressive in your storytelling, I'm fascinated by the idea, like, wait, can I not kill off my gay character because it would be like this, even though I wanted to do it all along? That to me, story-wise, is fascinating. Well, that's a whole thing. That's a perfect story about why life is gray and not black and white.
Yeah. Well, it's good. Thanks to Sam for the letter. This is definitely an interesting issue, and I do think that I think fans and people in certain communities ascribe a level of knowledge to people in positions of power that they sometimes fail to have, and that seems to be really what was exposed here, is that the producers of the show didn't quite realize what the depth and breadth of what they had built, and how much they had stepped in it when they made a story decision. And doesn't necessarily mean that was even necessarily the wrong story decision, but it seems to have been made and executed without understanding of the history of this. I mean, I think no writer wants to write a cliche, right?
Right.
And so if somebody in the writer's room, and maybe this goes to some diversity in the writer's room too, for all I know, of somebody, nobody in the writer's room saying, really? You're gonna kill right. the lesbian girlfriend, and that's how yeah. Sort of, and not even like dramatically, but like accidentally, and that's how you're gonna write her off. Do you realize what a cliche that is? Any writer confronted with that would probably be like, "Oh crap, I can't do that."
Yes, right.
Let's do something different. But I think that seems to have never come up. So, yeah, ouch.
Yeah, it's interesting. Wow, that's good. That's a good question. I didn't answer that on Twitter because I hadn't seen the episode yet.
Yeah, it's hard to deal with this topic. I mean, we just spent 10 minutes talking about it. This complicated. It's kind of too mm-hmm. complicated for Twitter. On
yeah,
top
definitely.
Of it.
And that sometimes I run into that and I have a gigantic
and,
exhale.
You know, fans get mad. Fans get mad about stuff, and I have a hard time with it too because you know sometimes your favorite show does things that you don't like, and that mm-hmm. does not that is not malpractice when a show frustrates you. You may not like it, and you may even stop watching the show, but it's not a show's job to make you just happy about everything all the time. You know, that's not, this is what I say about Game of Thrones. It's the same thing. It's like, it's really depressing. A lot of people are dying. It's like, yeah. And if this is all there is, that's going to be really crappy. But I don't think this is all there is. I think this is, you got to have the low point before you bring it back around. And, you know, for some people, that's not, they're not interested in that. And I get that. But, you know, it's hard when you talk about storytelling choices because making fans unhappy is not by itself a crime.
Exactly.
Yeah. Too much for Twitter.
Too much. We barely
Too
contained it in our own
Twitter.
Podcast.
I know. It's true.
That's a big thing.
Well, let me give you the numbers, or do you have, are you going to Columbo me?
No, I'm no, I promise.
Okay. Here's how you can reach us. You can send us an email, podcast@tvtalkmachine.com. You can tweet at us @TVTM. I'm Jay Snell on Twitter, and Tim is Bastard Machine on Twitter. You can also post on the aforementioned Facebook page, facebook.com/TVTalkMachine. So check us out by any of those methods, and we will try to read your feedback on the air, but we have been getting a lot of it lately. So if we don't get it on the air simultaneously worldwide released, we're sorry about that, but maybe next time. And that's it. Tim, it's been a pleasure. It's good to be back.
Yeah, welcome back, and take a rest.
All right.
We'll come at it strong, fresh material.
Okay.
New letters, new topics, new reviews next week.
More. It never ends. Platinum Age just goes on and on and on. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We will see you next week.